So what did they gain in Ukraine? Today, Tuesday, February 25th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. They ousted Ukraine's president and forced new elections, now planned for May. But for the protesters in Kiev, the struggle is far from over.
People are much more peaceful now, but the mood is very somber. Nobody is sure that this is really the victory.
Also, a new government is forming in Egypt, but military authorities there continue to crack down on dissent. This correspondent says it doesn't bode well.
This is the kind of action that fueled the instability that led to all of the Arab Spring uprisings.
And later, learning the secrets of home cooking from some very enthusiastic immigrant cooks in New York City.
I love to cook.
Yeah.
I cook every day. I cook every day.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It feels like there's a lot of unfinished business in Ukraine. Ousted President Viktor Yanukovych is still on the run, and the country's parliament has now asked the International Criminal Court to try him for mass murder. That would be related to the deaths last week of more than 100 protesters, many apparently shot by government snipers. Meanwhile, the country's political future remains unclear as various factions in Ukraine jockey for position and power. Ukrainian novelist Andrei Kurkov lives not far from Kiev's Independence Square, the heart of the protest movement that toppled Yanukovych. There have been some steps forward, he says, but residents are still on edge.
Finally, we have police on the street, sometimes accompanied by the representatives of the self-defense groups from the protesters. But I am wary because in the Crimea, the situation is very tense. In the east of the country, there are still fights between pro-European protesters and those who actually are not really pro-Russian, but more anti-European and anti-Western Ukrainian.
What does it feel like today down at the Maidan?
Well, there is some kind of strange order. Now some of the barricades are removed, but the people are there. The people are staying there probably until 25th of May, until the day of presidential elections, and maybe even longer, because normally we never have president in one round of elections, so there will be second round. And people are much more peaceful now, but the mood is very somber. Nobody is happy, nobody is full of joy with the victory, because nobody is sure that this is really the victory which will end the problems.
Yeah, but still, you're probably breathing a little easier today. For the past almost 3 months of demonstrations, you've woken up with the same ritual, right?
In the beginning, I was waking up every 2 hours to check on internet. You would just go half asleep to the computer, have a look there, and then I would go to the window. We live on the fourth floor, and I always park my car downstairs. And on our street, one of the cars was burned down. A lot of cars were damaged, and all my neighbors removed their cars.
You know, you write with great heart about the buildings that have been central to this uprising, like Mikhailovsky Monastery. What was happening there during the demonstrations, and what's become of these buildings now?
It became like a monastery for the protesters, because on the first night when they were running, on 29th of November, they were running people followed by riot police up towards the monastery. At that time, the monk, Father Ivan, opened the gates of the monastery, let everybody in, then closed it, and then went up to the belfry and started ringing the bells. And the people from Kyiv, from around the area, started coming to the monastery. And since this moment, actually, this church became a symbol also of uprising, and it is still helping a lot. I mean, people from Maidan, I mean, they are walking in their helmets with the long wooden clubs. They leave their clubs or their weapon outside the monastery gate and outside the entrance to the church, main church, they leave their helmets.
Well, it sounds like a really heady scene.
It is, and it's still going on. And I mean, today when I was taking my kids to the school, I was passing by the headquarters of Security Service, which is a huge building, Stalin's color gray and Stalin's architecture. And in front of the main gate, there were five or six masked protesters, also with clubs and in bulletproof vests, the head of SBU, of Secret Service, together with 9 of his deputies fled. But the people are still working there. Nobody knows actually what is happening at the moment. There is a new head, but no information, except that, of course, Secret Service was also involved in different operations against the protesters.
So clearly a lot in Ukraine that's not settled, and many people on guard. Novelist Andrei Kurkov speaking with us from Kiev. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The turmoil in Ukraine dimmed some of the Olympic lights focused on nearby Sochi. Doesn't matter. Russian and Olympic officials have declared the 2014 Winter Games in Sochi a success. The Black Sea Resort is hoping to capitalize on that by attracting new tourists to the area. Now, Sochi's neighbor to the south, Abkhazia, was hoping for some of the same, but tiny Abkhazia wasn't invited to the party. Its uncertain status as a breakaway province of the country of Georgia did not help, and Russia, whose security forces control the border gates, sealed off Abkhazia for the duration of both the Olympic and the Paralympics, which are coming up. Reporter Jacob Resnick has more.
Abkhazia sits just south of Russia, on the eastern shore of the Black Sea. It's a verdant subtropical paradise, once considered the jewel of the Soviet Union. But when the USSR collapsed, Abkhazia became a province of newly independent Georgia. Soon after ethnic Abkhaz began demanding autonomy, the eventual civil war left 20,000 dead and displaced more than 200,000 ethnic Georgians. Georgia continues to claim this territory, a stance backed by the United States and European Union, and rejects Abkhazia's independence, which is recognized only by Russia and a handful of other states. Towering over the capital city, Sukhumi, is the former Soviet-era administration complex. With the help of the caretaker, we break the frozen padlock for a look inside. From atop the 12-story burned-out shell of a building, you can see the Black Sea coast, long a top resort area for elites. These vacation towns are about the same distance from the Olympic ski slopes in Russia as Sochi, and locals had hoped that people attending the Games might stay here. But it wasn't to be. During this 6-week period around the Olympics and Paralympics, Russia has imposed a 7-mile security buffer. The border has been sealed to traffic. Except for vital goods by special permit, all trains have been canceled to and from Russia.
Okay. So basically he recommends that within this 11-kilometer zone, obviously it's best not to have the interviews.
A first attempt at interviewing people at the border was frustrated by a polite yet firm Abkhaz official who said journalists couldn't work inside the security zone. But around the corner, a cafe owner named Gunda is all too eager to share her opinion. She points to a pair of women at a nearby table who normally shuttle goods back and forth to Russia.
Look at these women. They left their families far from here, and they're living in someone else's house so they can work on the border. They're the breadwinners, and now there's no work.
The women nod in agreement, but are quick to affirm their allegiance to the Russian Federation. Not only are they allowed to work across the border, they also get a pension from the Russian government, which is why they say they support Russian athletes at Sochi. They can't actually root for an Abkhazian team because Abkhazia isn't recognized by the International Olympic Committee. Jarnaz Benia, Abkhazia's head wrestling coach, would like to see that changed. Wrestling is big here, and Benia's coached some world-class athletes, but almost always under the Russian flag. Benia is showing off a new sports complex in his hometown of Gudauta. He says these 11 new facilities will help develop world-class athletes in disciplines from soccer to gymnastics to wrestling in towns across Abkhazia. He says the dream of coaches and athletes here is that the international community recognizes Abkhazia so we can compete in the Summer Olympics under our own flag. But that might take a while. Abkhaz officials praise Russia for supporting them, both financially and militarily. Russia has deployed thousands of troops in Abkhazia, ostensibly to protect this country from invasion. Georgia considers this a military occupation of its territory, and so believes that Abkhaz authorities here are mere puppets of the Kremlin. This month, Georgian officials called on Olympic visitors to stay away from Abkhazian resorts and vowed that Georgia will never give up the territory. And so the stalemate continues. Abkhazians ask the world for recognition as an independent state, while Georgia's government says that will never happen and demands that Russia stop propping up what they see as a rogue regime. In the meantime, Abkhazia's people are missing out on Sochi's $51 billion Olympic party just up the road. For the world, I'm Jacob Resnick, Sukhumi, Abkhazia, or Georgia, depending who you ask.
In Spain, people are still talking about a TV program that aired on Sunday, which promised to rewrite a key chapter in modern Spanish history, and it delivered, sort of. More than 5 million viewers tuned in for the program, an expose about a 1981 attempted coup that nearly ended Spain's fledgling democracy. Here's more from the world's Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
The coup attempt 23 years ago is ingrained in the psyches of Spaniards, the way JFK's assassination is in ours. On February 23, 1981, a handful of Spanish civil guardsmen stormed Parliament during an open session, shooting their weapons in the air. They took legislators hostage, declaring they were now in charge of the country.
La corona, símbolo de la permanencia y unidad de la patria.
As every Spaniard knows, it was the young King Juan Carlos who saved the day. The monarch went on national TV to order Spanish soldiers not to join the revolt. The coup was crushed.
La primera información de la que nadie había tenido conocimiento hasta ahora.
That's been the accepted version of history anyway. But Sunday night, respected Spanish journalist Jordi Evole presented new evidence. Turns out the king didn't save the day. He staged it. The coup was a hoax designed to thwart a real coup still in the works and to boost the king's image. For more than a few Spaniards, it's safe to say the sky fell. Except actually, the hoax was the report itself. Evole, along with other well-known Spanish reporters and senior politicians, produced a mockumentary. It was called Operation Palace. It was a joke, as in, ha-ha, we tricked you. But few people here seem to be laughing. Evole and co. have been lambasted on social media. How dare they make light of such a sensitive subject, people tweeted. And why? In the final credits of Operation Palace, the players themselves offer clues. It was funny, some say. No historical event should be put on a pedestal, says another.
Yo sé que en este momento habrá espectadores.
And then afterwards, Evole appears. I know lots of people probably want to kill me now, he says, but we wanted to do something like the mockumentary Dark Side of the Moon from 2002, which questioned the lunar landing. But at least we told you ours was a farce at the end. A lot of lies get told on TV, he says, and no one steps forward to tell you. Evole's point seems at once cautionary and a shot in his own foot. Question everything you see and hear, even when you hear it from us, your most respected journalists and statesmen.
The world's Jerry Haddon there in Barcelona. And Jerry, stay with us here a moment, and let me just get this right. A real coup, but a fake doc last weekend that claims the coup was a hoax. A lot of double negatives there. So tell me more about the reaction from Spaniards. Are people outraged by this film that was presented as reality?
Essentially, the majority of Spaniards have been extremely indignant about the whole thing. They felt duped, and this is a very sensitive issue in Spain. The mockumentary's director, Jordi Evole, has been making the rounds to different media today, justifying the joke. He's been saying everything from, you know, lighten up to, you know, this was a protest against a Spanish law that keeps much of the record of the coup sealed and classified for up to 50 years from the date of the coup itself. So in other words, he's saying, if the government won't let us know the truth, let's just make up our own.
What about just, you know, journalistic credibility to be presenting a documentary and then kind of turning around and saying, eh, fooled you?
So, yes, that's been the main question raised. Does it damage their credibility? As one editorial in a Spanish newspaper said yesterday, you know, who's to say if they've done this once that they won't do this again? So, and this wasn't just your typical gag where you let someone hang for 30 seconds and then nudge, nudge, wink, wink. This went on for an hour. It was very highly produced. It starred, you know, former politicians, intelligence officials from the time, the real players from history, as well as a handful of very famous current Spanish journalists.
Well, Orson Welles doesn't have nothing on these guys. The world's Jerry Haddon in Barcelona. Thank you.
You bet.
Still ahead on The World, sand, sand everywhere on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Guggenheim in New York City is the perfect museum, in my humble opinion. Not too big, not too small, and the venue itself, a Frank Lloyd Wright design, is a work of art. But all of that was not front and center on the minds of protesters who streamed into the museum last Saturday evening. Their goal was to denounce the exploitation of migrant construction workers in the United Arab Emirates, specifically those workers toiling on Saadiyat Island, future site of the new Guggenheim Abu Dhabi branch. One of the protesters in New York was Natasha Dillon. She wants the Guggenheim Foundation to do more to protect workers' rights in the UAE. And she says that Guggenheim's flagship building was the perfect place to send that message.
It was beautiful. In fact, one of the artists recently wrote an article about how Guggenheim, New York, is the perfect building to protest because it's got that vacuum of a space and the spirals and that. And we actually thought about that while we were planning our performance inside the museum.
You call it a performance. So did you kind of go to the top in the elevator and then kind of protest your way down the spiral?
We actually had six different teams who were at different levels of the spiral, and we had a coordinated script that we spoke along with banners.
And what were you saying? What was the script?
So basically, we started by saying, who's building the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi? Just asking that question. And then we went into migrant workers in labor camps, migrant workers who demand their rights, migrants working in 130 degrees of heat. And so it keeps going on, and it keeps kind of bringing the migrant worker back to the museum, to art, to the future of art.
Yeah, fair question. What is the future of art?
What is the future of art? And especially when there's a futurism exhibition going on at the Guggenheim right now.
Right, Italian futurism. Great moment
yes.
to drop it, yeah. Well, the Guggenheim director, Richard Armstrong, took notice and released a statement saying that the organization is committed to making progress on the issue of fair labor in Abu Dhabi, adding that the construction for the Guggenheim on Saadiyat Island has not started yet. So I'm just wondering, are you happy with that response?
Of course not, because, you know, that is something that they've said before. And what we say is the construction already began with the fact that you've already started organizing events around Guggenheim, Abu Dhabi. Also, you're part of the cultural capital of the island, right? So there are other institutions that are getting built as we speak. The space to build the institution has been cleared up. So, you know, we're not happy with the response because I think as a team, they could do something together. So it's not just one-off. It's not just one institution. It's a collective of them on the island.
And what about your protest? Is it a one-off? You're going to go back to the Guggenheim?
We haven't planned anything yet, but, you know, we put out a statement asking Guggenheim to open its doors this coming Saturday again to actually have a conversation about these issues in an assembly format and make it free for public. This was our response to the statement that Richard Armstrong put out. So let's see if he responds to that.
Natasha, have you ever taken part in a demonstration before?
I have, but not, you know, just on and off. Not really as much.
Probably in a street somewhere, not in a place like the Guggenheim.
I have, actually. I was part of Occupy Museum, so I have been to
really?
MoMA and other places, yeah.
So you've got experience in this domain.
Yeah.
Natasha Dillon, thanks for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
By the way, we reached out to the Guggenheim today. They said the protesters have yet to contact the museum directly. We stay in New York City for our next story. New York is often called the world's melting pot because of all the nationalities that live side by side there. And quite literally, there's a lot cooking in that pot. Imagine being able to visit with wonderful cooks from all over the world in their kitchens while never leaving New York's five boroughs. That's exactly what the world's Nina Porzuki did.
Every New Yorker knows that if you want really good Greek food, you head to Queens. So on a recent Sunday, I headed to a two-bedroom apartment in Elmhurst.
Are you for the cooking class?
Yep! To learn the secrets of Greek cooking. This Nina Economou is my instructor for the day.
Nina. Nina Despina. Nice.
She's a member of the League of Kitchens, a new cooking school where the teachers are immigrants and serious home cooks. And the classroom is their kitchen. Four other women had gathered that morning for the lesson inside Despina's tiny kitchen. And we're talking New York City here, so think small and then think even smaller. On the menu that day, a bean dish, lentil soup, and my favorite, tiropita, cheese pie and phyllo dough crust.
Five eggs, four to go. I love to cook.
Yeah?
I cook every day. I cook every day.
Despina came to the U.S. in 1942 as a nurse. She only planned to stay 2 years, but then she met her husband, also a Greek immigrant, and...
So I'm here 42 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
And though Despina says that she feels very American, her cooking is very Greek.
Now,
I do the eggs like this.
The idea for League of Kitchens was thought up by Lisa Gross, a native New Yorker and the daughter of a Korean immigrant.
My Korean grandmother lived with my family when I was growing up, and whenever I would sort of try to help her in the kitchen, she would always say, oh, don't worry about cooking. You should just go study.
So Lisa never learned to cook any of those Korean dishes that she loved. And after her grandmother passed away, no matter how closely she followed a recipe from the internet or a Korean cookbook,
nothing ever really came out exactly like how my grandmother made it. You know, it always felt like there was something subtle but important missing. And then I sort of had this fantasy, wouldn't it be amazing to have quote-unquote grandmothers from all over the world that you could cook with and learn their family recipes and cook with them in their own home kitchens?
Lisa spent 2 years searching for home cooks, interviewing them, tasting the recipes, until she found 6 cooks to launch the school. They're from, well, Greece, of course, and Afghanistan, Korea, India, Bangladesh, and Lebanon.
When you think about how many incredible home cooks are out there who are only sharing their knowledge and experience, probably with their own family and maybe a few other people in their community, you know, it just seems like such a ripe opportunity to create greater access to all of this incredible knowledge.
That access is key. Being inside Despina's kitchen, it's almost like you become instant family, doing the dishes.
Yes. Hello?
Oh, for picking up the phone. And you can't hang around the kitchen without gossiping about lazy husbands.
Oh my God. He doesn't even warm up his food. He's one of these Greeks that, oh, can you give me a glass of water? Meanwhile, I have 1,000 things going on in the kitchen, and he's sitting, start eating. Can you give me a glass? I said, come on, get up and get your water. Crazy. Are you married?
And of course, there's the food. The gyropita came out of the oven golden brown. The cheese not too salty. The phyllo dough flaky.
The cheese pie is so good.
And as we all sat down to dinner that we had made together, the Despina stood over us like, well, a proud grandmother.
Thank you.
Cheers. Cheers. Kali Oreksi. For the world, I'm Nina Perzuki, New York City.
Despina.
Thank
you.
You can find Despina's recipe to that delicious-sounding tiropita. Try it, you non-cooking lazy husbands. And a fun video from the kitchen of Sunny Kim representing South Korea in the League of Kitchens. She teaches us about homemade soy sauce and the importance of good kimchi. So important. That's all at PRI.org. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, a challenge for political jingle writers in Colombia. How do you write a radio spot for a candidate who's known only by his number on the ballot?
Probably what we would do would be to play the number. 1-7-2-1-7-2.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. In just over 3 years, Egypt has gone through lots of leaders. A dictator, 2 presidents, a couple of military strongmen, and several prime ministers, all come and gone. And today, one more. The country's interim president appointed a Mubarak-era official as Egypt's next prime minister. Financial Times correspondent Borzu Daragahi is in Cairo. He says the resignation of Egypt's previous government surprised some, but wasn't completely unexpected.
The interim government has looked increasingly weak, ineffective to many people, and in many respects sort of unable to meet any of the challenges of the current time, either security-wise or economic-wise, Some of the ministers even were surprised. They heard on television that they had been canned, essentially. And other people that we talked to said that it was really the president and the military forcing this government to resign, because it really makes no sense. You're supposed to have a presidential election in maybe 1 or 2 months. So why change horses at this point?
Right. And today, a Mubarak-era construction magnate was chosen by Malab as the new prime minister. So just who is Ibrahim Malab?
He's in his mid-60s. He's a former member and a leading member of Hosni Mubarak's National Democratic Party, now dissolved since the 2011 revolution. And, you know, coincidentally, around this, just preceding this cabinet change, you had the real power in Egypt, the field marshal, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, heading to Russia and cozying up with Putin. So this just gives you an idea of where the government here is headed.
So what do the revolutionaries make of all of this?
To some extent, I would say, and many of the revolutionaries would say, that this is merely rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, that there's not going to be much of a difference in who is in charge of this government, that they don't view legitimately anyway. But this does sort of diminish the hopes of those who had hoped that the country would move in a more democratic, inclusive direction.
Borzu, sometimes it's the little stuff outsiders would not notice that's revealing. What have you seen lately that seems to indicate where things are headed in Egypt?
I remember during the recent one of the trials of Mohamed Morsi, there was some children out there protesting against the Islamist government and in support of the military, and they had taped military boots to their heads as a sign of sort of subservience.
Wow.
To the armed forces. And you know, that just really struck me as really emblematic of the kind of spirit of conformity that is prevalent among many Egyptians, the worship of the military and the kind of submission of the self under the jackboot of the armed forces and their prevailing ideology.
For those who really feel the jackboot on their heads, what's it going to take to take that boot off?
Well, I think that many Egyptians are just so frustrated with the instability and chaos of the last 3 years, which incidentally, I think the military contributed a lot to it. They wanted to turn Egyptians off to the idea of democracy and liberalism for, you know, a very long time. So I don't think that they were an innocent party in much of the chaos that subsumed Egypt over the last 3 years. And, you know, anything and anyone that promises law and order is going to be accepted by the bulk of Egyptians who are just craving some stability and a resumption of the economy. The problem is that the formula for stability that the Egyptian authorities are presenting right now is the same formula that Mubarak used with such disastrous results. Strong hand of the security forces, imprisoning people who don't agree with you. This is the kind of action that fueled the instability that led to the 2011 uprising and indeed to all of the Arab Spring uprisings.
Borzu Daragahi of the Financial Times in Cairo. Thank you very much, as always, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
Our House is on Fire could be a metaphor for Egyptian politics, but it's actually the title of an exhibit by Iranian visual artist Shirin Neshat. If you know her work, you'll recognize her style in many of the exhibit's black and white portraits of Egyptians. They're overlaid with Neshat's trademark black ink calligraphy. The photos explore the consequences of Egypt's revolution through the eyes and faces of those who've lost loved ones in the violence.
There are portraits of people who are above 65. Each portrait is of a man or a woman whose eyes are swelled with tears, majority of them. All of the images are inscribed with millions of words that go underneath their skin, the wrinkles, etc. That adds another dimension in terms of content, voice, where the images of the people looking directly into the camera and have an obviously very painful emotional expression.
Yeah, why use the calligraphic black ink on some of these photographs? At times it's almost like a smudge, at other times it's like a tattoo.
With these particular images, I chose to write extremely small text because the images were so powerful in their human expression that I didn't want to use the kind of calligraphy that dominates the face. The gaze was so important to me. But generally, for me, the use of text with the image, it's a way to add this emotional dimension. The poetry that is used sort of transcends the political dimension of the work and sort of brings the humanity, the poetry of all of the subjects to me.
And in the middle of all this, the photographer you work with, Larry Barnes, his daughter dies, and that adds another layer of emotion as you're taking these portraits in Cairo.
As I was about to go and sort of capture the sense of loss on personal and national level for the people of Egypt, my closest collaborator, his young daughter who's grew up with my son, sadly died by total accident. So he was in the process of mourning, and I knew once we got there for him was a way to find a way of healing in a way by being surrounded by people who are also suffering in different dimensions. I mean, the added dimension for these people in Egypt, the ones that I photographed, was that they were extremely poor. So poverty, political injustice, corruption, chaos, violence were an added, to their loss of children, to their aging. So we were surrounded by people who were cornered in all these different ways. And I do believe by Larry's presence, by him sharing his personal narrative and tragedy, it created a sense of bonding and trust with these people who may have otherwise not have had that kind of trust to share with two foreigners their most intimate and personal feelings.
Yeah, just extraordinary faces. Yeah. How did you find these Egyptians?
Once we set up studio in downtown Cairo, the janitor of the building himself was an elderly, hardworking, poor man, and he was one of the subjects of my photographs as well. And I asked him if he could help us by recruiting the people that of his friends, his community, the street peddlers, to people who were mechanics, people who had, small jobs to survive, or even housewives, grandmothers, people who needed a little bit of money as we were able to compensate them, for us to talk to and photograph. So it was really him who was able to tap into the community and bring us people who, again, were extremely poor and old. And one by one, they came up and shared their stories with us and opened up.
And why did you focus on people who were 65 and older? Why are there no younger Egyptians in your portraits?
Well, in principle, I think that as people get old, they no longer look so much into the future but the past. And I think, as opposed to the young people who have a tendency to just look into the future because they have a whole life ahead of them, and they have this sense of optimism. And perhaps that is why the people who become activists are so fearless and courageous, is because they're not afraid of life. But as you get older and you have experienced the passage of time, you realize the sense of loss in all these different dimensions. For many of these people, the added tragedy of perhaps have lost their children in this process of revolution, or have seen catastrophic violent events before their eyes, for them it carries a kind of a wisdom that the young people wouldn't have.
There are also photographs that you've taken of feet and tags on toes. Explain what they mean.
In order for the audience to understand the context of this sorrow, at least from the Egyptian perspective, it was important to have images of the morgues that I had seen. Images after the military invaded the Muslim Brotherhood sitting after Morsi was overthrown, one after another, images of young people who were dead in the morgue with their feet and a simple tag between their feet that sort of identified who they were. And I found these images so disturbing in the way that, at the end, your life is reduced to this little tag that identifies you. And I just felt that, it was really important to this narrative to include images that really suggest the brutality and the inhumanity of politics and, the violence that is always somehow intersecting this kind of sense of activism and political conviction that it starts with such points of innocence and goodwill.
Well, what you've produced is really fascinating. Shirin Neshat, thank you very much for speaking with us about it.
Thank you for covering it.
On to another photography story now. This one is a bit lighter. It involves diamonds and a desert, a French photographer, and a German ghost town. Definitely the kind of story that's worth more than just one look, which is why the world's Clark Boyd is taking this week's Sideways Glance.
French photographer Romain Veillon's got a thing for abandoned places. He traces it back to a childhood spent playing near an old, forlorn castle.
I always love abandoned houses. It's like it's frozen in time. And you can see and smell what people used to do there 10, 20, or 30 years ago. And There is a very, very unique atmosphere in this place.
But there are few atmospheres quite as unique as the one Vaillon explores in his latest photo project, The Sands of Time. It features Kolmenskop, an abandoned German diamond mining settlement smack in the middle of the Namibian desert. The story starts a few years back, when Vaillon came across a picture of Kolmenskop in National Geographic.
Until now, I've been hunted by this photograph, and I wanted to go by myself.
But trips to Namibia aren't cheap, especially for freelance photographers. So Vaillon started saving his money and doing research. Kolmenskop, the story goes, was founded in 1908 by a German worker who stumbled across a diamond in the desert not far from the coastal town of Lüderitz. At the time, Namibia wasn't Namibia. It was a German colony. Anyway, you can imagine what happened next. More Germans started pouring in to look for diamonds, which they had no trouble finding, apparently.
Actually, the legend says that even during the night, you could find diamonds thanks to the moonlight.
And with miners came families, and with families came the need for amenities. By the mid-20s, some 700 families called Kolmenskop home. The diamond-funded lifestyle meant plenty of creature comforts. German-style houses were built, along with a school, a casino, a ballroom, a bowling alley. A tram, deemed to be Africa's first, connected Kolmenskop to Lüderitz. The town had its own mini ice-making factory, a street-sweeping team to clear the sand, and a swimming pool.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert, so it became very rich very fast. I think they import champagne from France.
Ooh la la. Yeah, the hospital even had an X-ray machine.
Yeah, it wasn't used to heal patients. It was just used to see if workers have swallowed diamonds during the day.
By now, you can probably see where this is going, right? I mean, after the boom comes the bust. The town's heyday started coming to an end when bigger, better diamonds were found farther south. People started leaving, and by the early 1950s, the hospital closed, and that was about it for Kolmenskop. The buildings, and a lot of stuff in them, were left to gather dust, or sand, rather, as Vaillon found out when he visited Kolmenskop for a week last summer.
For example, the school, the bell of the school is still there. Some buildings have been preserved and have been rebuilt exactly the same as it was before, but some of them are just really, really covered in sand.
Now, you can visit Kolmenskop on a guided tour, and local choirs sometimes use the Kolmenskop Gymnasium for practice. But to go to Kolmenskop by yourself, you need a special permit. Good for one day, sunup to sunset. Bayonne bought seven of those permits and hung out, waiting for the light to be perfect and the ghost town tourists to leave.
The sand makes all the place like magic. You have a very strange atmosphere. It feels like, you know, a movie, an apocalyptic movie where humans are gone and you're all alone.
Little wonder that shots of Kolmenskop were used for an apocalyptic horror film called Dust Devil, or that the BBC used it for scenes in its documentary series called Life After People.
What would happen if every human being on the Earth were to suddenly vanish?
Well, if Kolmenskop is any indication, the sand moves in pretty fast. Vaillon's surreal pictures, some of which you can see at PRI.org, show doorways and abandoned bathtubs filled with sand. There's the shot of the abandoned swimming pool, the diving board sticking out over a giant pile of sand. The light plays eerily off of shutters. Ghosts, Vaillon says, are everywhere.
Yeah, it's like it's haunted. You can see the miners working there and going to the swimming pool or going to the school.
Vaillon says there will be an exhibition for The Sands of Time in Paris later this year. He's also working to release a book based on his time in Kolmenskop. In the meantime, Vaillon's already scoping out the next project. He hopes to visit Epequen, a city in Argentina that, until recently, was submerged for more than two decades under salt water. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd.
Sand in your living room, halfway up the doorframe. I've seen Vaillon's pictures from Namibia. You, too, will be transported. We've posted a slideshow at PRI.org. Tomorrow on The World, how Mexican mole was invented, not by restaurant chefs, but by sisters in Mexican convents, just mixing up what they had on hand. Chef Barbara Sibley grew up in Mexico, and she'll connect Mexican history with today's Mexican food on The World tomorrow. This is PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What if candidates here in the U.S. had to compete against thousands of other political hopefuls? They'd probably do what politicians in Colombia do. They'd hire musicians to write jingles about them. Reporter John Otis met up with some composers in Bogota who've been jamming for next month's elections.
¿Ya con esta idea?
At a Bogota sound studio, Juan Fonseca dabbles at the piano. He's composing a 15-second radio spot for a Colombian congressional candidate. Radio reaches more people in Colombia than newspapers or TV. That's why a well-crafted jingle played over and over on the radio can help a campaign take off. But composing these ditties is a strange and tricky art form. Just ask Santiago Ramirez of Bogota's Real Sound Studio. He recalled a button-down conservative, a sort of Colombian Mitt Romney, who thought he could connect to younger voters by setting his jingle to raunchy, sexually explicit reggaeton.
Yeah, we were like, what? Do you really want a reggaeton? Yeah.
Ramirez produced the jingle, and the candidate lost. Another challenge? Politicians who have strange names that are hard to rhyme.
Now we're working with a guy whose name is very weird. It's Telesforo. It's very similar to phone, you know, the number, like Telefono, Telesforo.
Who names their kid Telesforo?
I don't know, man. A very crazy guy, but Telesforo.
Still, Ramirez says numbers are even more important than names.
We don't have any name. Did you listen?
The spot simply urges people to vote for candidate number 101. Here's why. Unlike U.S. legislative races, which are mostly one-on-one contests, Colombia's are a free-for-all. A whopping 2,300 candidates are running for 285 seats in the Colombian House and Senate. As a result, the ballot for the March 9 election is the size of a newspaper, but it still isn't big enough to hold so many names. Instead, each candidate is assigned a number, and that's what appears on the ballot.
In Colombia, when you go to vote and you have to mark with an X the number of the candidate, that's super important.
Miguel de Narváez runs a recording studio called Sonido Comercial. He says a good melody or chorus can implant the candidate's number in the voter's brain. Jingle writers prefer small numbers because they're easier to rhyme. But what about big numbers, I ask? Like 172?
No, 172, that would make it very difficult also. Probably what we would do here would be to split the number. 172. Instead of 172, that's you're not going to learn it.
Repite.
When we meet up again, Juan Fonseca, the piano man, has finished the jingle for his client, a congressional candidate named Monica Giraldo. Rather than reggaeton, Giraldo requested a more innocent sound. So Fonseca brought in a teenager to sing the vocal tracks.
Liderazgo, firmeza y dedicación. Una mujer que trabaja con el corazón. Mónica Giraldo, comprometida con su labor.
Giraldo, of the Conservative Party, is listed as C-102 on the ballot. But Fonseca resists playing the numbers game. In the end, politics is all about people. So Fonseca tried to make an emotional connection with voters by focusing on Giraldo's human qualities. She's a person with leadership skills who puts her heart into her work, he says. All of these attributes make her much more than just candidate number C-102. For The World, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
Finally today, Mardi Gras. I know it's not till next Tuesday, but if you're in Haiti, it's already party time. In the southern city of Jacmel, for instance, lots of parties there and parades and dancing to local sounds like compa and rara. Popular Haitian musicians performed on Jacmel's carnival concert stage this past weekend. Also there, Régine Chassagne and Wynn Butler. They're the power couple behind Montreal alt-rock band Arcade Fire. If you ask Régine, they were basically there to have fun.
I don't know. Where do we fit in? We're just celebrating and offering what we have. So we're a band, so we're going to play music. So that's what we're bringing to the party. Some people bring food. Well, we bring music.
Régine Chassagne of Arcade Fire there, speaking to reporter Marissa Neff, who was in Jacmel for the early festivities. And Marissa tells me there's more to the Arcade Fire and Haiti story than just fun.
Régine's family, her parents actually fled Haiti in the 60s, and she has long wanted to go down there and went down there several years ago. And the band has actually had a partnership with an NGO called Partners in Health, and they've been going down and doing work with them. And actually, they started donating $1 per concert ticket to Partners in Health.
And for Régine, it sounds like it's also very personal.
It is, it is. She went down there for the first time after her mother passed away. And she really felt like it was just this very cathartic experience. And it felt very familiar to her as well.
My parents, especially my mom, had such a traumatic experience leaving in the 60s because she had people from her family killed, so she never wanted to go back. Even though I had never set foot here, I could really relate to it, and it just made me realize how much you can absorb from just your parents. It was basically exactly how I imagined it.
So we're going to hear right now, Marissa, what Arcade Fire got up to in Jacmel, Haiti. Set the scene for us, Marissa. Who else was on stage in Jacmel with them?
The group Simbi Roots joined them on stage, and that's an all-female rah-rah band. And they were wearing all kinds of colorful skirts and playing vuvuzela-esque horns. And that's rah-rah music is the music that you really hear on the streets during Jacmel Carnival. And it's just raucous and loud, and you can't help but dance and get involved.
Full-on introduction for Rara for the members of Arcade Fire in Jacmel, Haiti. Reporter Marissa Neff in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, at the airport getting ready to leave. You've been well-dosed on Carnival this year. I think, Marissa, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
When the sun goes down, when the sun goes down, you'll get inside.
We leave you with Arcade Fire and the Haitian band Simbi Roots performing the tune Here Comes the Nighttime. And that's our program for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.